Welcome to
Killing It
on Broadway. I'm Jennifer Simard.
And I am Jessica Vosk, and this is the podcast where we discuss all things guts, gore, murder, and mayhem.
It's not safe for work. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, Jennifer. So, Jen, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about how all of this came about?
Sure. Long story short, here we are in the pandemois. And wait, Jessica, I love how you have coined coronavirus, the Coco Roro.
Yeah, you know, in the midst of such crazy times, we have to find something to get us through. And I just have to say that for me, it would be calling it the Coco Roro. It is now the Coco Roro.
Absolutely. And I coined it the pandemois instead of the pandemic. It's just, as you say, it's important to sort of emasculate this bitch at every turn. Right?
Oh, God. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Like everything with our partnership together, we're perfect, i.e. the Coco Roro pandemois. Anywho, one day I decided I was going to do this podcast by myself. And then one night I put a shout out on Instagram, sort of just to give an informal poll to some of my entertainment friends to see how many of them were also fascinated by true crime. Turns out, a lot. And I told my pals, you know, if you're one of those people, you know, just give me a thumbs up back. And lo and behold, Jessica not only sends me a thumbs up emoji back, but she sends me a message in all caps. Do you remember what you said, Jess, in answer to the question, are you into true crime?
All day, every day.
All day, every day. And then I couldn't sleep. I was like, wait a minute. Dun, dun, dun. We should do this together. Because we kind of have been a little obsessed with each other for a while. Am I wrong?
It's a true story. It's an absolute true story.
Right. So then I was awake. I was like, the coffee's on. And from about 2 a.m. to 4 a.m. Oh, by the way, we both love our coffee. We have that in common, too.
I'm truly drinking a new version of pumpkin spice that I made in my kitchen.
Right now?
Okay. Yes.
Hold it up. I've got my iced coffee here. Yep.
I'm holding
it up. Your toast.
I'm holding up my little latte.
Yep. Amen. Cheers. But yeah, so from about 2 a.m. to 4 a.m., I rewrote the concept for two instead of for one. I pitched it to you, and here we are.
You're the brains.
And you're the brawn. No. You're the brains, too. Seriously, our brainsicles really do complement one another, right?
I'm going to say absolutely yes. We have found through this process that we bring something completely different to this, basically exactly like unicorn glitter.
Just like that. Now, Jess, you're from New Jersey, right?
Yes, I am.
and you are from New Hampshire, yes?
I am. Absolutely. Live free or die. And today, dear listeners, we decided to introduce you to us, your hosts, by highlighting cases from our home states, New Hampshire and New Jersey.
Just so you know, also dropping today is our very first interview, which is the actual format of our show. So each week we will be interviewing stars from Broadway and beyond about their love and obsession of true crime and highlighting one case from their home state. So you guys, you must check out our very first interview show with the one and only, drumroll please, Kristen Chenoweth.
I'm not going to give anything away, but when I say we got a scoop, Jess, we got a scoop.
Dare I ask, are we journalists now?
We might be. Maybe in a Rita Skeeter sort of way. I don't know.
But are we going to win the Pulitzer?
We might. We might. Mm-hmm. You guys, no spoilers, but Kristen Chenoweth will share with you all publicly for the very first time her very personal connection to a very famous case. So check it out. But since we have that interview in the can, I like that. It's old timey style. In the can. It's in the can. I can't hear in my can. It's in the can. We thought you should get to know us, your host, just a little bit.
Schmadoodle Zachly. So Jen, how did you first know you were into true crime?
Well, let me start by saying I was always into mysteries. They were my favorite book to read. I was an avid reader as a kid. I read through the entire Agatha Christie series, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. And then, of course, I tried to watch all of those movies and television shows on television. I Love Me, My Murder, She Wrote on Sunday nights. You know, I just loved mysteries. And finally, I have to say this, Jessica, I did tell my brothers that we were doing this. And I told them separately. And each of them said to me, Mom would love this. One of them, in fact, said, Mom would be a producer of this show, Jen. And I forgot, of course, the reason why I'm into true crime is my mother. My mother wanted to be one of four things that she never was, but you were going to discover she's quite the tomboy. She wanted to be a baseball player, a carpenter, a cowboy, or a private investigator.
I am obsessed. It's giving me a League of Their Own entrepreneurial vibes.
Don't you love Yvette? You love Yvette.
I love Yvette.
But Yvette, she said she wanted to be a PI as long as, you know, she knew she wouldn't get hurt. So anyway, she is really probably the main reason why I'm into true crime.
Well, this I love. I'm... Again, another reason why you and I are soul sisters in the true crime way. So I am personally very, I mean, it seems weird to say I'm excited to hear about this case, but I'm very intrigued, I guess I should say, to hear about this case. I do not know it well. I'm sure there are many listeners right now listening to us in their ear holes who would also like to hear about this case. So please do us the honor of telling us what happened.
Okay, so today I'm going to do a case when I was about 20 years old, to which I have a peripheral connection. This is the tragic, unsolved murder of Rita Roy. Now, credit where credit is due, besides my own memories, I did get a lot of my information from the New Hampshire Department of Justice, Dateline NBC, and the New Hampshire Union Leader. Regarding the very first article I read about this case way back when, in real time, and recently, again, when I was doing research for this, was an article written for the Union Leader by Sissy Taylor and John Clayton, who, Jessica, is the uncle of our friend and Broadway star, Max Clayton. Can you believe that?
The circles are so small. That's all.
So small. And that's about the end of anything good that I have to report. So here we go. On Tuesday, May 21st, 1991, at approximately 8 a.m., I drove to my receptionist job at the R.J. Sullivan Cigar Factory building in the Mill Yard district of Manchester, New Hampshire. As usual, I'd go upstairs to the fifth floor with these beautiful arched windows, make the coffee, get the conference rooms ready, and sit down at my L-shaped mahogany desk, ready to start my day and recept. About 3 hours later, at approximately 11:15 a.m., just a mere 300 feet away from where I was sitting, sweet grandmother Rita Roy was being brutally murdered. Rita Roy was an upstanding citizen who made the world a better place by being in it. On this particular day, she was driving to the hotel at the center of New Hampshire to an awards luncheon with the Crotchard Mountain Foster Parents Program, of which she was a member. According to reporting by Julie Curley for Dateline, Rita, as part of this Easter Seals Grandparents Program, volunteered her time and acted as a, quote, grandparent figure for infants and toddlers in foster care. Now, there were several conferences happening at the same time in the venue that day, and it was generally a place of hubbub with lots of shops and restaurants. I would often walk across the breezeway between my building and it and spend my lunch breaks there. More on that later. But on this busy Tuesday, the garage for the venue was quite crowded. As the garage was full, this meant Rita had to drive all the way to the open-air rooftop of the garage, which arguably is more comfortable and safer than the enclosed, darker spaces inside. And let's talk about that. I think, Jessica, I don't know how you feel about parking garages, but I think most women are trained to be careful in environments like that. What do you think? I mean, are you spooked out by garages?
I am physically, no one can see me right now, but I am shaking my entire body. Yes, if that's possible.
She is.
Yes.
I'm looking at it right now. She's
yes,
shaking.
I am. Yeah, of course. I mean, I have a garage in my building that I currently live in, and I always get a little scared shitless every time I have to walk, even though it's very well lit. I mean, the thing is, do you have your mace? Do you know your surroundings?
Do you have your keys in your...
Yeah.
You put your key around your index finger and you hold the sharp end out.
Yes. I mean, these things are like the key rules of being a woman that you learn about when you're in these, especially a garage, because you hear the stories of somebody breaking into your car and sitting in the back seat and then
yes.
Right?
To this day, I still look in the back seat before I get into the driver's side. I do.
Me also as well. Hashtag. Thank God there are cameras everywhere and surveillance everywhere and footage to be found just in case something horrible happens. But mm-hmm. I always walk faster. I'm always looking behind me. I've always, if it's dark, I've got my flashlight on my phone. So Jen, yes.
Yes. And to be fair, it's so important not to victim blame. If something happens to you, it doesn't mean you weren't being careful. right? That's the thing. Like, things can happen whether you're being careful or not, which is so scary. And I do think I read her grandson, Rita's grandson, had said that she didn't really care for garages. I got the impression, although this is not a quote, that she was a very careful person and would have been more comfortable, like you and I would have been. It's not wintertime. It's May. It's warm. Much more comfortable up on an open air roof. You know, where it's not dark and you can see more clearly all around you, which is one of the things that made this so scary, because I've been there and it doesn't feel as scary up on that roof as it does in the dark underbelly. Anyway.
Right. The garage is still a scary place to me. It will always remain a scary place to me. So I can't imagine, you know, how scary that must have been for her, knowing that she didn't like it to begin with. You know,
that's
just awful to think about.
And I often will take out my phone.
I pretend I'm on the phone with someone. I will do that. I will walk past that person and be like, I'm here. I'm here.
Jessica, I'll also pretend to be fighting as if I'm an aggressive person. You don't want to mess with me.
Well, that's something I've never done. And now I'm obsessed with you even more. Now I'm obsessed with you to the point, like, let's become siblings.
Anyway, let's get back to this horrible story. And it's horrible. So here is poor Rita. She's on the roof. On the roof, there's a hallway vestibule attached to the building with an elevator, which would take her down to the conference level. She goes inside the vestibule, waits for the elevator, and it is here that Rita is surprised by an unknown assailant and inexplicably attacked. Now, we know this because it was pieced together in post from the crime scene evidence. Unfortunately, here in 1991, there were no CCTV cameras. Rita was stabbed in the elevator vestibule. She then staggered back outside approximately 15 feet before collapsing on the garage roof. Soon thereafter, another woman had taken the elevator up to the same vestibule, which is where she saw the blood and blood trail leading to poor Rita, who by this point was lying on the ground. According to this initial report in the Union Leader, she had been stabbed in the stomach and in the neck, and that the wound to her neck severed her jugular vein, which resulted in massive blood loss and ultimately her death. Within a day, police released a sketch of a suspect. According to an article by Nancy Mearsman in the Union Leader, police generated this sketch having talked to two female eyewitnesses whom the suspect allegedly scared in the parking garage earlier in the day. Soon thereafter, flyers were distributed around the entire area, including inside and around my office building. Now, I said I'd get back to this later. As I said, I worked on the fifth floor of this building. The third floor of the building, two flights down, has to this day a small, maybe 30-foot long breezeway attaching it to the garage in question. I'm going to post pictures of all this on the Instagram page so you can see just how close everything is and to get some context. Now, one of my coworkers, whose husband was an FBI agent, came in holding a flyer and asked me, Jennifer, doesn't this look like the creepy guy who was loitering around here? And I, looking at the sketch, said, yeah, that looks like the guy who stole money from my purse.
Dead.
When you, right?
Okay. First of all, I touch my hair when I freak out, and I touch my hair. And second of all, that would have given me like my stomach falling out feelings. That would have made my stomach fall out.
Yeah, I was spooked. I was scared. I'll be honest with you, because look, feelings aren't facts. I really believe feelings aren't facts. However, there is something to using your instinct. In fact, my sister-in-law, Becky, she's just starting a podcast called Now Fear This. And she also, side note, she just graduated from a little school called Cambridge University. She got her master's in criminology. And I think her thesis was, or excuse me, they call it a dissertation over there, but her dissertation was about the science of intuition. So my point is, though feelings aren't facts, you do have to listen to that little voice in your head. You do have to listen to the pricklies up the back of your spine, and you have to let them inform you and hopefully prevent further crime. That it's both things, right? It's statistics and intuition. And I have to tell you, as much as my eyes are green, that I didn't mean to be overly emotional, but I really did feel spooked by this fella. At the time, something was not right. Something was really, really off. And I wasn't the only one that felt that way.
Yes. And I'm just saying this. I'm just saying intuition to me is everything. When I think something is wrong, I'm always a trust your gut kind of gal. I really am. I'm not like, let me give it a second chance. If I think something ain't right, that shit ain't right, sis. I mean, I truly believe that. this to me, it's the tingles.
And this fella did give us all the creeps. I was not the only one who saw him. I was not the only one who had experience with him. And, you know, I'm not saying that the guy who stole money from my purse is the killer. I don't know if they're one and the same. He could have just been a burglar. But I do want to tell you this story because it goes to illustrate one of the many leads the police got that ultimately went nowhere for the fine police department who just wanted to solve the case for this family. So rewind to just 2 months earlier in March. I remember this specifically because it was my dad's birthday and I had taken an abnormally high amount of money for me, $300, out of the bank to immediately go shopping after work and buy him a new trench coat for his birthday.
That's very nice of you to do. I just want to say that.
Thank you, Jessica. Am I going to stop calling you Jessica? I just love it so much. Instead of Jessica,
it's a very Northeast style of speech, and that's
We are both from the industrial Northeast, so
yes. And $300, like if you're taking $300 in cash out of the ATM, I still find that to be some major liquid on me. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I don't want to walk around with $300 in cash,
right? And you got to be tough. You got to be Jessica, not Jessica. Jessica.
And that's why you were Jenna Fall. Okay.
Okay. Moving on. While I was at work, I kept my purse under my desk. On this day, this guy, whom I've never seen before, walks in and asks me an innocuous question, which resulted in me having to leave my post to check on the answer. When I came back, he was gone. I never left my desk again. And when I went to gather my things to leave at the end of the day, I discovered the money was gone and I immediately pieced it together. Fast forward several weeks. I honestly can't tell you if it was late April or early May, but it was definitely between the first robbery and the murder. I'm sitting at my desk and the same guy walks in like a shark returning to fertile waters. And you know that tingling sensation you get on your spine when you're talking with someone with your eyes and they're doing the same thing back and you both know that you know? That's what happened. In 1 second, I was scared, steely, and in survival mode because I'm alone in the front of this office with this guy who stole $300 from me. We were both wide-eyed and he knew I knew. This time he asked me some bullshit question like, where are the bathrooms? And I icily responded, they're right outside the door you just came from. Note that one of the two eyewitness women from the garage in May said the suspect asked her a question. He asked her for directions. The question man, I don't know, coincidence? Now, regarding robbery, Rita's purse was found with her, but both her purse and her wallet were untouched. Was it a robbery gone wrong? Was that even the motive? Did she fight back and the assailant panicked and killed her? Was it a criminal who escalated to murder for the sake of murder, a thrill kill? It was almost 30 years ago. I think the police came around and talked to everyone, and I relayed my story, but like all their other leads, they went nowhere. Once the police revealed the revised details of the suspect, a white male, 35 to 45 years of age, 5 feet 10 inches tall, with slim build, brown hair, and wearing glasses, in addition to the sketch, of course, they were inundated with tips, all about men fitting that same very common description. A few days after the crime and the initial sketch, the police released a second, different sketch. Now, to be clear, the person I saw resembled the first sketch more than the second. I will post both on the Instagram page. So when I post these pictures, you guys, just if you know who the person is by some miracle, you know, let the police department know. You don't post it publicly on the Instagram page or elsewhere. You know, we're just following the rules of etiquette regarding these things. You know what I mean, Jess?
Oh, I love etiquette. I am a lady. I'm full of etiquette. I should take etiquette class, but the etiquette.
Keep in mind, it is 30 years later. We'd have to have a forensic artist. Is that even what you call it? A forensic artist?
I'm going to say that you do call it a forensic artist or some type of, you know. Yes, we're going to call it a forensic artist.
Okay. A forensic artist. They'd have to try and draw what they might look like now, right? Like, remember, like, well, we'll do John List one day, but, you know.
They have systems now that will actually, based on, you know, a prior photo or sketch being taken, they're mm-hmm. able to sort of do this.
Exactly. I'm studying forensic psychology. I should know this, you big dumb. But anyway, like they need to create some jowls, maybe a nice crow's feet situation.
We got to have some forehead lines. This person mm-hmm. probably didn't have the time to get Botox is what
some
I'm trying
nose
to say.
Hair, ear yeah. hair. Okay. Yeah. So they need a forensic artist to do this. I mean, who knows if the person is even still alive. All absent further information, this is just a sketch of a suspect seen in the vicinity. This is not a sketch of someone from an eyewitness account of the murder itself. As far as we know, that doesn't exist. One of the theories was that this was a random killing and that the assailant hopped on a bus, headed out of town, never to be seen again. Now, by hopped on a bus, again, proximity, people. My office building also shared the same driveway as this bus station, which I'll also post pictures of, as well as some videos about potential escape routes. The police also got a lead about a guy seen speeding away in a red pickup truck. People phoned in saying they saw a guy who fit that description and that it looked like the guy in the sketch. There was also a similar crime in Boston. Could that be related? There were several incremental rewards posted by Good Samaritans for information leading to an arrest or conviction. All led nowhere. Rita's funeral, attended by 400, was held across the street from my grandparents' house on Rosemont Ave at my grandparents' parish at St. Teresa's Church. I wonder if they knew her. According to an article by Nancy Mearsman of the New Hampshire Union Leader, Rita was, quote, remembered at her funeral as a woman with a generous heart who brought up several foster children as her own, giving them the first real family they ever knew, unquote. Also note, Rita had two grandsons of her own whom she loved and both of whom loved her in return. As a sad footnote to the story, Rita was a widower, having lost her late husband Leo in 1969, also to murder. He had been hit in the back of the head with a rock.
I'm sorry, your husband also suffered a murder? That's truly, I mean, horribly poetic. It really is.
Absolutely. And I'd love a listener who is better at math and statistics than I am to let me know. I mean, what are the chances?
Oh,
both spouses being murdered separately over 30 years apart. Anyway, finally, when I think about the fact that next May will be the 30-year anniversary of this unsolved murder, it gives me pause as to whether or not justice will ever be served. Most times, I don't think so. The one thing I think at this point that might bring this to an end is if the killer told someone. According to an article by Sissy Taylor in the Union Leader, Lieutenant James Stewart said, quote, it's hard to believe someone could have done something so heinous and not say anything to anybody, unquote. I agree. There is no statute of limitations on murder. If you have any information, you can email the New Hampshire Department of Justice Cold Case Unit at coldcaseunit@dos.nh.gov or call the Manchester Police Department at 603-668-8711. And that, in part, is the story of the taken too soon Rita Roy. All these years later, my heart still goes out to her family, and I hope one day they'll receive justice.
I mean, in listening to that story, that's the thing, right? You hear from family members who have been through these awful experiences, who have had to deal with an unsolved murder, cold case for such a long time. Some of them, unfortunately, have never been solved all of these years later. And you think to yourself, that's the one thing families always want. They say, could we just know so that we can put this to bed, so that we can say goodbye to our family member, so that we can truly, you know, have closure. And closure is, I hate that word sometimes because it means something different to everybody and it's not all encompassing. It's different for everybody and anyone who's going through something shitty. But you find that you just want these families to be able to have peace, I guess, in whatever it is they are looking for. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. And I, you know, you just feel such empathy for them. And I will say, I remember at the beginning of this case, we thought it really stood a good chance to be solved. I mean, there were so many tips and you just thought, you know, it's hard to, I think the levels of acceptance, speaking only for myself, come slowly. And you have to remember, it really was a different time in terms of technology and forensic science. And luckily there have been advances, which is why there's always hope, because there is some evidence that potentially could be used, you know, if they did find someone, from what I understand. But I, again, it's very hard when you have they have no witnesses, they have no real suspect. And like I said, that drawing, I mean, you know, my story is anecdotal. This, you know, that was a drawing of a person who was seemingly suspicious, but that's not proof by any means, you
right.
know, and God knows, like, I would not be able to recognize this person all these years later. I mean, I saw them for maybe 30 seconds each time. So, you know, it's really tricky.
This episode is brought to you by our best friends at Spindrift. Yes, you heard me, best friends. For those who know us, you know how addicted we are to true crime. and sparkling water. Cue the day when we were both starring in Broadway shows and stumbled upon the Holy Grail, Spindrift.
America's first sparkling water with real squeezed fruit. Yep, that's it. 11 flavors with no worries about any chemicals going into your body. You'll have a crush on all flavors, trust us.
Oh, and they make the perfect mixer for your holiday bevvies too.
Ugh, the possibilities are endless. Just go now to drinkspindrift.com, find your match, and use our sassy sparkling code KILLIT20 at checkout and get 20% off your first order. Self-care, baby. After all, it's necessary in 2020.
Anyway, now, Jess, I'd like to extend the same courtesy you extended me by asking you when and wait, let's give a nice aspirated. Is it aspirated H? Yeah, we like that. Well, let's give a nice aspirated H. When and how did you first know you were first into true crime?
Oh, man. Like you, I loved growing up. I loved anything murder mystery. I loved the scary camp stories. I loved the ghost stuff. I loved a Ouija board. I don't F with that anymore because I'm too scared now. But I also... I want to say 13 or 14 when Princess Diana died. And I remember my mother being devastated. And I remember, you know, subsequently learning that it could have been a setup. And I became obsessed with that story. And then subsequently in high school, I took an advanced criminal justice class. Sorry, not trying to make myself seem cooler than everybody, but I did. And I took an advanced criminal justice class in which we really studied the case of O.J. Simpson. And again, I became obsessed. And again, one of the things that we did was we visited a maximum security prison. There were only a few of us that really thought we were going to go into law. I'm not kidding. A lot of my fans out there know that I, in addition to loving true crime, I almost went into law. And so I was a heavy debater and a heavy criminal justice gal. And I've been obsessed ever since, which I'm sure a lot of people kind of have that thought themselves of, oh my God, I remember studying this crime specifically, or we did this thing in school and it got, you know, I got bitten with the bug of true crime. So, so there you have it.
I love it. Jessica, what case do you have for us today?
Well, interestingly enough, my case is also a 1991 murder case. And
you're kidding.
I'm not even kidding you. And I will tell you also that the two of us, to our listeners out there, we didn't have a little chitty chat of what year we wanted to do these murder cases. We picked our murder case, pick a case, any case. And they just happened to be both in 1991.
And I bet we were the same age in 1991, right?
That, absolutely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I can't wait to discuss it. So ladies and gents, and everyone out there, this is the murder of Timothy Wiltse. Now, I just want to be clear. When I say to you, I am a very proud Jersey girl, we all know that I'm the typical, you know, I'm full of the attitude, I'm sassy, I'm gritty, I take no BS, but I am a teddy bear if you're going to talk about where I grew up, which is the actual garden of the Garden State. It does exist. There are trees, farmland, and deer. And that being said, in addition to that garden area, I'm also very well aware of the fact that the mob and the Sopranos and the mafia is the very Jersey mentality that has been taken on since the dawn of time. I'm no different. I love it all. I love all that stuff. And the crimes have always been enticing to me. But the crime that I'm going to discuss today, however, is one that took place in a town just 11 minutes from where I grew up, which freaks me out just thinking about it because the crime itself, like I said, took place in 1991. I was eight. So was Jennifer.
I was eight too. Yeah.
Yeah. And the victim, Timothy Wiltse, was 5 years old, which is about how old my younger brother would have been at the time. Timmy, as he was called by his family, was with his mother, Michelle Ladzinski. She was 23 years old, and they were at a Memorial Day festival on May 25th, 1991. I'm talking typical carnival style, family-oriented event. One would think there was no way this type of heinous crime could happen, yet...
Jessica, wait. May 25th. So this is the same week.
Get out.
Not only the same year, it's the same week.
Well,
Yeah, this crime that I spoke of was May 21st. And I don't know if the crime is on May 25th, but you brought up May 25th. So this
this is the crime. The crime was on May 25th.
It's the same week, girl. When we didn't know what each other was doing.
This
I'm really
the spirits.
This is the spirits. Okay. As you were.
So all of this happened at a carnival where Michelle, Timmy's mom, told police that Timmy went missing at the carnival and completely vanished from her sight. So Miss Ludzinski told the police that she had looked away for just a moment to order a soda when someone snatched her son. Now, as you could imagine, the carnival itself was completely shut down once they heard of a child missing. A huge search was conducted. We're talking helicopters, search dogs, people helping out as volunteers, and nothing was found. And these were the days when, and Jen, you can probably also attest to this, where children's faces were being plastered on milk cartons all the time if children went missing. Timmy's face was no different. His disappearance attracted national attention, just mega national attention. I mean, you had like sports celebrities holding up a milk carton with his face on it. And Timmy was also featured on America's Most Wanted. Remember that old chestnut?
I do. Even though I was 8, I remember it.
Same. And he was featured on it twice. Still, nothing came from the show. Yet, the public and several eyewitnesses at this carnival, some who knew Michelle Ludzinski personally and some who were acquaintances, and the police, they noted that there was something off about Miss Ludzinski. I'm going to dig into that deeper. However, Michelle's story changed over time, which is something I'll talk about in a little while. But according to everyone who had spoken to her and seen her, she came across either as cold, a little bit calculating, or, quote, perky, as some have said.
Do you mean like perky, like trying too hard, do you think? Or what do you mean?
Yeah, I'm going to say from what I've read, perky, like a little too happy, a little too shocked, and maybe laughing a little bit. And that's why people said, this shit seems weird. Something's not right. And it was a few of, let's just say, the many reasons the police said they hadn't completely eliminated her as a suspect in her son's disappearance. However, she was not the number one suspect off the bat, but they did keep her on the back burner. Now, we're going to fast forward a couple of months to October 26th, 1991, when a school teacher named Dan O'Malley, I mean, he sounds like a fabulous Irishman. He was bird watching. Okay. Which again, I'm an avid bird watcher, says no one, in the Raritan Center Business Park in Edison, New Jersey. So who knew that there was bird watching here? Congrats. I hope he saw some good birds. However, while Dan was there bird watching, he discovered a child's Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles sneaker. Say that 5 times fast.
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. No, that it's between Ninja and Turtles.
Exactly.
It all goes to shit.
That's exactly right. But thank God for all of this earlier media attention on Timmy, because Dan recognized this sneaker as the shoe Timmy had been wearing when he disappeared. Because Michelle, Timmy's mother, said she had recently bought him these Ninja Turtle sneakers. So Dan took this shoe to the police. They did some forensic testing, but they didn't find anything. Cut to a few months later, we're into 1992 now. So I'm going to introduce you to now retired FBI agent Ronald Butkiewicz, who led the charge. I know. I'm going to have to call him Agent Ron.
Mostly, I'm so proud of your pronunciation. That's not an easy name.
I had to sit down with it last night before we recorded this several times to really say it properly, because it borders on making me laugh. But also, I'm respectful of the agents. But Agent Ronald, we'll call him, he was the one to lead the charge in Timmy's disappearance and called it, quote, the biggest unfinished piece in my career, end quote.
Oh God.
I know. Now, here's the interesting part and why I just, if any of you listening can relate to this. This is why I love forensics. It's why I love those who decide to get into the field of either FBI agent or police or forensics for this reason. Ronald had earlier interviewed a woman about various jobs Michelle, Timmy's mother, had held around the area. So this is a woman that knew Michelle as an acquaintance, and she mentioned a particular area near Edison. So boom, light bulb goes off. This is where the guy was bird watching. Detective takes out a map and has her point to the specific office location, and her finger fell onto almost the exact spot where the child's sneaker had initially been found. Soon after this little tidbit of information, Agent Ronald ordered a search of the entire area. And wouldn't you know, little Timmy's skull was recovered. After this, Mr. Buckowick, Agent Ronald added, quote, killers dump bodies often in desolate areas with which they are familiar. And the skull is usually the first thing to be discovered during a search because it looks like nothing else found in the woods, end quote. And at this point, they found Timmy's remains. They were so badly decomposed that the medical examiner could not determine any cause of death. To add on to the fact that they couldn't find a cause of death, I mean, this goes to show in the early 90s, forensics, you know, DNA, all of this stuff, you know, we didn't have the capabilities yet. But I personally, I don't know about you at this point in the story, I can sit here and let you know that I truly believe that Michelle absolutely had something to do with the death of her precious son. But again, DNA was still in its infancy at the time, and this was all circumstantial. Jen's raising her hand, and I'm going to tell you right now, I'm going to call on Jen.
Do you remember the OJ trial in 94, 95? When they were saying those numbers to the jury, you know, they didn't understand the language. You know, it was
right.
Now I think we've taken for granted DNA, but when it was first starting out, you know, you might as well have been speaking in Pig Latin. No, people were like, what is this? Yeah, right. Okay. Like, people didn't trust it.
Of course, you know, because again, you don't trust what you don't know. And now, you know, we've got so many different advances all these years later, but back in 91, 92, they didn't find anything. And because of the situation still, because of the location to Michelle's office job, she was still questioned. But she had a whole hell of a lot of inconsistencies in her story and her timeline. So first, her story was that she claimed to be at another park that day. So according to park police, that park that she claimed to be at was closed. Then she came back with another story, and she claimed that two men with a knife had taken Timmy and scared her into silence. One day after that second interview story, she finally claimed that a woman by the name of Ellen, who she says was a customer of the bank where she worked, had taken Timmy. Now, the FBI did an extensive search, and no such Ellen existed. Oh, yes. And Michelle also failed two polygraph tests. Now, needless to say, as many of us crime addicts have come to understand, a failed polygraph does not make you a murderer, especially if there isn't any hard evidence, which, again, drives me insane because I want to solve every single murder. I don't know about you, Jen, but
that's literally why we're here.
Literally right? why we're here. And I want you all to know at this point, Fred is sitting so close to me and obviously is very intrigued by this entire podcast. So
He's scared.
He's very scared to hear it. He really is. And this is why I don't do the Ouija board. moving on further. Now, Jen, here comes some movie type shit.
Oh, God. Okay, I'm ready.
This is where it starts to really get weird. So 2 years after Timmy's death had been ruled a homicide, it was absolutely ruled a homicide, and it was an open case in investigation. 2 years after this, Michelle claimed she had been abducted and taken to Detroit, Michigan by FBI agents who were attempting to, quote, teach her a lesson for talking about Timmy, end quote. Riddle me that one, Jen.
Well, okay. Were the FBI agents aliens? Did they land on a spaceship and beam her up to Detroit?
Great question.
That would be
a great question.
Okay. That'd be my first theory.
I'd say it's a wonderful theory. And mm-hmm. and subsequently, she returned home 2 weeks later.
With an anal probe.
An absolute probe and mm-hmm. a computer, really installed under her skin. Mm-hmm. And she returned home 2 weeks later, and her brother had found an FBI business card on her door that read, quote, "It's not over," end quote. But Jen, remember mm-hmm. our pal Agent Ron? Agent Butkowitz?
Agent Butkowitz, I believe is his name. Yes.
Correct. Well, he decided he was going to do some sniffing around, and he found out that Michelle had those cards made herself at a local print shop. So at this point, Michelle had no choice but to admit that she had faked her own kidnapping.
Wait, so it wasn't aliens?
It was not aliens.
Alien FBI agents.
It was definitely not an alien FBI agent, as much as we wanted it to be. Okay. She finally admitted to faking her own kidnapping. She did not say anything about Timmy. She kept her mouth sealed shut about any questions they had about Timmy's disappearance and homicide. And she was sentenced to 6 months house arrest and 3 years probation for the hoax that she created. Mm-hmm. And truly what gets my goat, I don't know about any of you, but what gets my goat about all this is that she then spent the next 4 to 5 years getting in trouble for the most random shit, like stealing a computer or making another hoax claim or doing just stupid shit. But the cops could not seem to pin her to the case of her killed son, of her murdered son. And so she's out free after her probation period, and she starts a new family even in 2001. She has two more children, but as we all know, and I dare say love, cold cases might stay cold for a very long time, but at some point the answers will eventually reveal themselves, and reveal they did. So in 2011, New Jersey prosecutors, they decide to do some cold case reviews. And this is, we're talking about 20 years to almost the day that Timmy went missing. No new DNA evidence was found, but something else was. And this something else would prove to be the ticket to the crucial new lead in this case. Any idea, Jen, what that something else could be?
A business card made by Jessica Vosk at 28 years old. I'm going to quit this job on Wall Street and be on Broadway.
God, you're so close.
Okay, that's not it?
It's not it, but...
Okay.
But you were so close, Jen. What they found, and they found it, I got to tell you, they found it in 1992, but it's just been revealed in 2011, and it was a blue blanket. So... In the initial discovery of Timmy, when his skull was found, about 30 feet from his skull, the police found a pillowcase, a balloon, a shovel, and some remnants of the waistband from Timmy's underwear and shorts, but there was also a tattered blue blanket. But they still couldn't make a case at the time in 1992. However, prosecutors decided to take a harder look this time. They went back in the files. They interviewed several acquaintances of Michelle's who were at the carnival that evening. Some of them said they never saw Timmy in the first place. Can you imagine?
Mm-mm.
People saying, I see Michelle at the carnival. I don't see Timmy with her.
I don't see the son. Yeah.
Yes. Wow. But more importantly, investigators then realized that Timmy would never have been walking around at a carnival carrying a 10-foot blanket in 90-degree weather. Mm-hmm. How did he wind up with this blanket? It made absolutely no sense to investigators. So they then concluded the blanket had to have been taken from Michelle's South Amboy home to cover Timmy after his death.
Oof.
How did they come to this conclusion? Because Michelle vehemently denied ever having such a blanket. But there were three babysitters of Timmy's, who all at separate times proved Michelle wrong and all mentioned the blue blanket.
Oh, I want to interview the babysitters.
I know. If you are one of the babysitters, please get in touch with us. Mm-hmm. We want to know your story, because there was a specific babysitter, most notably, her name is Danielle Gerdig, who without doubt said that this blue blanket was from Michelle's home. She would fall asleep with it on the couch in the evenings that she would babysit Timmy. It was a very well-known blanket because she could describe the house completely. She could describe the color of the living room, the color of the couch, the color of the chair, the carpet, and always remember the blue blanket. Even further, according to Gerdig, on May 25th, 1991, Timmy wasn't there with her. And now we've reached August 6th, 2014, which would have been Timmy's 29th birthday. Michelle Ledzinski was finally arrested and charged with her son's murder. They finally had all the evidence after several files had been reopened and examined by the court. And I have to tell you, Michelle Ledzinski's brother, who had, you know, stood by her and claimed her innocence this entire way through, handed over a 200-page FBI report to prosecutors because he said, "We just want to know the truth. Please prove us wrong." That's pretty deep.
It is.
Now, the judge, Judge Dennis Neves, he issued a key pre-trial ruling where he stated that Michelle Ledzinski's several changed stories and all of her omissions established circumstantial evidence of her guilt. There you go. 2 years later, her criminal trial began on March 16th, 2016. Can you believe there was testimony heard from 68 witnesses?
Wow.
That seems like a lot of witnesses, doesn't it?
It does, especially considering how many years later this is. You know, I mean, I'm not in law enforcement. I'm not an attorney, but I agree. That sounds like a lot.
Yeah. It seems like a lot to me, but you know, notably we have the babysitters associated with Timmy that were kind of the star witnesses. And you know, clearly brought up the blue blanket they all recognized as being the blanket from Michelle's apartment. Needless to say, the jury was unanimous in their guilty verdict. It was finally handed down on May 18th, 2016, first-degree murder. And 1 week before the anniversary of Timothy's disappearance, and in January 2017, Judge Neves sentenced Michelle Ledzinski to 30 years in state prison without the possibility of parole. Now, Michelle has always maintained her innocence to this day and has never opened up about Timmy's case, about the how, about the when, about the why. And the murder itself will always remain a mystery. But what I can say is that 26 years after the heinous crime took place, we have finally seen justice for young Timmy. And it just kind of shakes me to the core that something like this could happen. I truly can't believe something like this could happen, but I really do think she did it. I guess the question is still up in the air. Do we think she did it?
Well, and she'll be about 80 years old when she gets out of prison. And I mean,
do you think she did it?
I don't know. You know, I feel like I'm just absorbing this. I'm the type of person that has to listen to the story several times before forming an opinion, generally speaking. I've heard it. I also need to read it. I need to visually learn something as well. But other than the murders themselves, in my opinion, there's nothing worse than being wrongfully convicted and thrown in jail if you didn't do it, right?
Absolutely.
But you're a smart cookie. And you have really delved into this. So what I can say is that I trust you. And if that's your opinion, then I would lean towards that way because you've done so much work on this. And honestly, yes, it was many, many years ago, but to have three witnesses, the three witnesses in the blue blanket is pretty damning evidence, you know?
I do. I think it is too. I have gone back and forth several times because that's the big old question with this case. And you know, credit, obviously where credit is due. I included my sources from Wikipedia, the New York Times, USA Today, My Central Jersey, America's Most Wanted. And in a lot of those sources, the question is, do we really think that she did this? And And I opened that up to any debate, really. And if anyone, like we said, if anyone knows about this particular case, has a tie, I would love to hear your thoughts on this. Because at the time, we're talking about a 23-year-old single mother. Yeah. And you know, it's pretty scary. It's pretty scary. Hey, Fred, can you come lay down? Come lay down, baby. Come on, lay down. Oh, God.
I love it. Thanks so much for joining us today, you guys.
Yes. And please, please do not forget to head right over and listen to our revelatory number one guest episode with the Kristen Chenoweth, available today.
Until next time,
keep killing it.
Don't kill anyone.
Crime fam, go to our Patreon page and join us to get exclusive bonus content. And follow us on Instagram at Killing It On Broadway and Twitter at Killing It On B-Way.
Subscribe to us wherever you download your podcasts.
And go ahead and give us a 5-star rating and lovely review. It'll be good for you.
Killing It On Broadway is a production of Killing It On Broadway, LLC.
Music by Mary Mitchell Campbell. Orchestrations, Benedict Braxton Smith.
Edited and engineered by Smokey.
Morale officers, Fred and Nelson. Say goodbye, Fred.
Say goodbye, Nelson.